appropriate that we have Kip Thorne describing to us further real things that general relativity and gravity are likely to bring to us. And Kip is going to talk to us about time and quantum non-demolition. Kip? And I hope to talk.
Yeah, I think we got this working. Let's put this in your pocket and put this like this.
Well, thank you, Doug. Jim has been a wonderful friend and collaborator for me since the early 1960s. I think we probably first met in John Matthews' class at Caltech when I was a senior undergraduate. And you and Jim Bardeen were first-year graduate students.
Right. You sat in the back and the graduate students sat in the front.
Yeah, and I and I got the worst grade at Caltech in that class that I had gotten in any class I ever took, and I attribute it to the likes of you and Jim.
There's a different explanation, but let's not...
A few years later, while I was a graduate student at Princeton working with John Wheeler, Jim came back to Princeton and we became much better acquainted then, overlapping, he as a postdoc and I as a grad student. And we both got our great interest in the real physical world from John and in the possibilities for applying general relativity to the real physical and astrophysical world. Jim came back, as you've heard, to Santa Barbara. I went back to Caltech on the faculty. And in the late 60s, we continued our close friendship and began a process whereby every once or twice a year, I would bring my students over to Santa Barbara, or Jim would bring his students over to Caltech. We'd have a little joint group meeting just because we were living out here in the wilderness where nobody else on the West Coast or nobody else west probably of very far west of Princeton was doing much general relativity at the time. Except for Jim Bardeen, who was way up north in Seattle by then. And so to have real intellectual interaction, it was a matter of Jim and me and our two research groups. Those meetings later, under the stimulus of Jim Eisenberg, got converted into and became the Pacific Coast Gravity Meeting, which we will have tomorrow and the next day. Also in the this period then, I guess it must have been the late 70s probably, mid or late 70s, I found myself for the first time in severe competition with Jim. When Santa Barbara was proposing to build the Institute for Theoretical Physics with funding from the National Science Foundation, Murray Gell-Mann and I and others at Caltech had a very different vision of what should be done with that NSF money. And we found, we found ourselves in Washington, D.C., making pitches in behalf of our own relative visions. And Murray and I, we at Caltech, were just not able to compete with the gang of four, the infamous gang of four, Jim, Bob, Ray, and Doug, who won out. And in retrospect, I'm very pleased they won out because this is such a superb institute. Their conception of this and how it has worked has really made a tremendous mark on physics in the United States and in the world. Over the years, I've often turned to Jim for advice about physics and occasionally for advice about life. I'm going to confine my remarks to the former. as Doug remarked, my physics is much less elegant, much less fundamental than Jim's. More closely grounded in the currently observable astrophysical world, or the soon-to-be-observed part of the astrophysical world. Though I do have real faith that the work that Jim has been doing in quantum cosmology will, in due course, have a much greater contact with real observations as time goes on. It's a tribute to Jim that over the years he has been able to work both in the astrophysical side of general relativity and on the side of its interface with quantum theory. And he's been able to do it with equal facility in both directions. And this morning we heard something about the directions in which he has worked on the quantum side. And I would like to focus on some of his past work that has stimulated me, and a little bit on some collaborative work that we've done on the astrophysical side. As usual, my talk is motivated by gravitational wave detection. So just as a brief update for people, we are involved in the LIGO project, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory project, which involves building two large interferometric gravitational wave detectors in the United States, this one in Hanford, Washington, and an identical one, almost identical one, in Livingston, Louisiana, and which will, together with a third similar instrument in Pisa, Italy, the Virgo project, a French-Italian project, will constitute an international network of multi-kilometer scale detectors. LIGO construction is now complete at both sites, and the experimental team is mounting interferometers in the vacuum systems. And so the project is moving forward on schedule and on budget. We are also looking forward to the prospects of opening up gravitational wave detection in the low frequency band. LIGO and Virgo operate in the high frequency band. For gravity waves, that means 10 hertz to a kilohertz or so. The low frequency band is something like 0.1 hertz to 10 to the minus 4 hertz. And that is likely to be opened up by LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, consisting of a triangular array of spacecraft that track each other by means of laser beams. LISA is currently an approved mission by the European Space Agency, but would not likely fly until something like 2018 unless it's done jointly with NASA. And so there is, in fact, now has been appointed by NASA a mission definition team for a NASA version of LISA, which we expect will be done jointly with the Europeans. Sterl Finney at Caltech is head of the mission definition team, and Jim has been the chair of a committee for the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences looking at the proposals for LISA and other issues related to the future of gravitational physics, and we eagerly await the output of that report on how you judge the future of this field. That is a visual conception of LISA with the arms slightly shortened. Now, motivated by LIGO and LISA, it is conceivable that LISA would have a launch as early as 2008. So we're talking a time frame that is now possibly as short as 9 years from now, possibly a little longer. Motivated by LIGO and LISA and Jim's birthday, I'd like to talk about tides in neutron star and black hole binary systems. Now, the LIGO and LISA motivation is the following, that we expect to search for the gravitational waves that are produced by the spiraling together of neutron star and black hole binaries by cross-correlating theoretical templates that are derived from general relativity theory for the waves emitted by such a system, cross-correlating them with noisy data. I removed the noise from these data, the red thing to the data. If the noise were there, you wouldn't even see the signal at all because the signals will be so deeply buried in the noise. But by doing a cross-correlation, we hope to discover these waves. And it's a major issue that the cross-correlation will start to decrease. The integral of those two waveforms against each other will decrease markedly if the two waves get out of phase with each other over the entire sweep of data that you have, cumulatively out of phase by as little an amount as a tenth of a cycle. Quite obviously, you'll see it in the cross-correlation. For neutron star binaries, LIGO expects to see something like 10 to the 4 cycles. And so we have to know the theoretical waveforms to an accuracy of something like a part in 10 to the 5, which is a real challenge for theory. The experiment is now driving theory in this field rather than the other way around. For LISA, a very interesting source is a 10 solar mass black hole spiraling into a 10 to the 6th solar mass black hole in the center of some galaxy out, for example, at cosmological redshift, say z equal 0.3, I've chosen here, 1 gigaparsec distance. If this is a rapidly spinning black hole, a equal 0.998, a value that is sort of the fastest that you expect black holes to spin in the real universe, then you can go through some calculations that I've done based on some numerical work by Sam Finn that's as yet unpublished. Assuming for simplicity a circular orbit in the equatorial plane, 1 year before the end of the inspiral, the orbital radius is 6.8 m. And there are 185,000 cycles of gravitational wave signal yet to come. And the signal-to-noise ratio is 100, if you can do optimal signal processing. That is, if you know the waveforms well enough to do that, to build that cross-correlation. 1 month before the end, R is 3.1 m. That's 1.5 Schwarzschild radii, and there are still 41,000 cycles left. And the signal-to-noise ratio is 50. And 1 day before the end, R is 1.3 m, and there are 2,000 cycles left, and the signal-to-noise ratio is still 10. So it's rather impressive the extent to which observations of these waves should really enable us to map out in detail the space-time geometry of the big black hole in the vicinity of the horizon. But even see the waves with these signal-to-noise ratios, we need optimal signal processing. We need to know the waveforms to an accuracy, say, a part in 10 to the 6 for the last year, a part in 10 to the 4 for the last day, very high accuracies. So what I want to focus on is the question of the influence of tidal coupling on the evolution of the wave's phase. That is, the influence of the feeding of orbital angular momentum into intrinsic spin angular momentum of a neutron star or black hole. Let me begin with neutron stars, a subject that I learned from Jim Hartle, actually, although it's a 19th century subject. Jim discusses this quite fairly briefly in a classic paper that he wrote back in Physical Review in the early 1970s, where he was considering the similar problem for a black hole. So you have a spinning neutron star. It has a companion. The companion creates a tidal gravitational field on the neutron star. So the neutron star develops a deformation, a quadrupole moment, as a result of that tidal field EIJ, quadrupole moment IIJ, that's proportional to EIJ, a constant of order unity, in fact, times the fifth power of the radius of the star, as Jim taught me. The star is spinning, generally, it usually be spinning more rapidly than the orbital angular velocity of the companion around it. And so, because of the internal viscosity, there in fact is a lag in the raising of the tide, so that as this star spins, you might have expected that the tide would be raised in such a way that it would point directly toward the companion. But the viscosity causes a phase lag. This is when you put a little bit of viscosity into a harmonic oscillator. It produces a bit of a phase lag between the response and the driving force. And so there is a tidal lag angle. That tidal lag angle then has a simple formula that is the most interesting issue. Is it's proportional to the difference in the two angular velocities. And Jim then reviewed for us how that leads to angular momentum transfer and between the neutron star and the orbital angular momentum. And you can go through the details using classical equations that come from 19th century physics. Chris Kachanik and independently Lars Bilstein and Kurt Cutler in 1992 went back and looked at this quantitatively in light of LIGO's needs and found that, yes, this is an issue, that this is going to affect the gravitational waveforms at a measurable level, but only in the last few orbits of InSpiral. So it's not a really big deal. It's not going to be a major issue that we have to struggle to deal with. Jim Hartle looked at the same issue in the case of a black hole. It was actually Jim and Stephen Hawking in 1972 who developed a theory of the evolution of horizons of black holes in response to external perturbations such as the tidal gravitational field of a companion. And then Jim himself, without Stephen, worked through details and discovered a rather fascinating phenomenon that in the case of a black hole, there is a tidal lead instead of a tidal lag. That is, the black hole is spinning, say, more rapidly in this diagram than the orbital angular velocity of the companion. And the surface of the black hole raises a tide on it, or a tide is raised on it, before the black hole is pointing toward the companion. And this rather surprising result, of course, is a consequence of the teleological boundary conditions for black holes, that the horizon of a black hole is defined in terms of future boundary conditions. It is the boundary of those parts of space-time that can communicate with infinity, with scry, plus, and those that cannot. And it's those future boundary conditions that lead to this fascinating tidal, that give rise to this fascinating tidal lead. Once again, the lead angle is proportional to the difference in angular velocities. In fact, in order of magnitude, based on what we understand about the physics, it's just the same story in order of magnitude as for a neutron star, but with this peculiar sign change. On the other hand, when you look at the angular momentum transfer, there is no sign change. There's a compensating sign factor that again comes from the teleological boundary condition, as Jim so beautifully explained to us in his classic papers here. But what I'm interested in for LIGO and for, in this case, for LISA, is the numbers. So let's look at that example of LISA, of a 10 solar mass object orbiting around a 10 to the 6th solar mass black hole. And let's look at the rate at which the tidal coupling is feeding angular momentum into the big black hole divided by the rate at which angular momentum is being lost to gravitational waves from the orbital motion. You go through the numbers and you wind up in that last month before a plunge when there are 40,000 cycles left, it's about a 5% effect. 5% effect means something like 2,000 cycles worth. It's an enormous effect. And so this sort of indicates that what people thought of in the early 1970s when Jim worked out this theory of a phenomenon that seemed extremely esoteric, it is going to become a huge measurable effect with LISA, an effect that we must deal with quantitatively with very high precision as LISA comes online. I've always found it this tidal lead a rather fascinating subject. And so I simulated, in fact, by Jim's birthday, I went back to look at it once more using some tools that were first given to us by John Wheeler back in the 1957, and then he elaborated on them in a chapter in the textbook that Wheeler and Misner and I wrote, and then tools that were further developed by Jim Hartle and me jointly in 1985. Let me just say a word about the genesis of this work that Jim and I did jointly. It was a usual situation where I had a physical problem I was interested in, which was the problem, in this case, of the precession of a black hole in response to tidal interactions with companions. And Jim had given us the foundations for the theory of the spin-down of black holes, but had not given us the foundations for understanding precession of a black hole due to tidal coupling to the quadrupole moment of the black hole. So I went to him and said, look, we really need to understand precession as well. And so together we worked through this, leaning back on the foundations that John Wheeler had laid. We did so by introducing a buffer zone around the black hole, which we called the local asymptotic rest frame, or LARF. This LARF is the region that is far enough from the black hole that gravity of the black hole is weak, but still near enough that the external gravitational field of the companion can be regarded as a small perturbation as well. I'm sorry, it can be regarded as something that is nearly homogeneous, and so you can treat that external gravitational field as a tidal field, or you can do a power series expansion in terms of the tidal field and its gradients, a power series in distance away from the source. So in the LARF, where we is the place, in fact, where the quadrupole moment of the black hole lives, and the place where the external tidal field of the companion live. That's the one domain where the two of them live in the same place and overlap. And in the LARF, then, following on the early work of Wheeler, Jim and I then introduced a power series expansion from the metric coefficients, a piece of the expansion that goes like 1 over r, distance away from the black hole, in which you have the mass and the quadrupole moment, and pieces that go as increasing powers of r, where you have the electric type tidal field, the electric type piece of the Weyl tensor. And similarly, for the off-diagonal elements, the spin angular momentum of the black hole and a magnetic type piece of the tidal tensor. And we then looked at the tidal coupling between the electric type quadrupole tidal field of the companion and the quadrupole moment of the black hole, and looked at the flow of angular momentum through the LARF, which we computed using the Landau-Lifshitz pseudotensor formalism. Thereby, we got an expression for what we were interested in at the time, which was the precession of the black hole in response to the tidal coupling. We were able to show that the standard 19th century formula for the precession of the angular momentum holds equally well for black holes and neutron stars, totally unchanged, as it does for any other kind of a weakly gravitating body. Now, returning to this subject in the light of Lisa, it's interesting to ask not about the precession, which is what Jim and I were going after, but return to the issue of the transfer of angular momentum that leads to a spin up of the or spin down of the black hole in this case, and a transfer of angular momentum to the companion to the orbital motion. Well, depending on the relative magnitudes of the two of the spin angular velocity and the orbital angular velocity, you can transfer angular momentum either way between orbit and spin, or between spin and orbit. But the important point that I wanted to mention to you, which you probably understood at the time, but which I did not understand at the time, is that when you go in and you look now in the LARF at the tidal field, the tidal field for a black hole shows the same lag as you have for a neutron star. You've got a lead of the direction of the deformation of the horizon, but you've got a lag of not of the tidal field, I mean of the quadrupole moment. The quadrupole moment, which shows up in the LARF, has a lag angle, whereas the deformation on the surface of the star has a lead angle, and that's just related to the difference of looking in the LARF and looking at the horizon. And that lag is the same kind of a lag as in the neutron star case, and you get then a reapplication of the standard 19th century physics to the case of a black hole, unchanged, since you're no longer dealing with horizon, but you're dealing with quadrupole moment instead of with horizon. I'd like to describe another little problem that is a outgrowth of thinking about physics from the point of view of the LARF. This was motivated by surprising numerical work by Jim Wilson and colleagues a few years ago, in which they studied neutron star binaries that were orbiting each other and spiraling together under gravitational radiation reaction. They found the surprising result that the coupling, gravitational coupling between the two stars, if the stars were close to the maximum mass for a neutron star, the gravitational coupling seemed to cause the neutron stars to go unstable and begin to implode before they started to merge. And that was a very surprising result, very disturbing if correct for LIGO, because this could have big implications on the evolution of the waveforms during the inspiral. So it's been very important to sort that out. And I want to describe a particular version of an analysis of this that is based on the formalism that Jim and I developed for understanding the precession of black holes. This is a version that goes as follows. I'm going to talk about the simplest example of this version, in which for simplicity I'll have the star be non-rotating as seen in the LARF, so that in that power series expansion the spin angular momentum of the star vanishes in the LARF. And I'm going to have a static tidal field. But this is readily generalized to having an orbiting that is a turning tidal field due to the orbital motion of the companion, and readily generalized to having a spinning star at the center. The foundation for doing this is a technique called static stability analysis that's actually due to John Wheeler again, and so much of this field really is due to John. He described this analysis, presented it in a book that he wrote and kindly put my name on with him, called Gravitation Theory and Gravitational Collapse, back when I was a graduate student. I think I wrote about 5 pages of the book myself. And he taught us that if you look at the equilibrium configurations for neutron stars, or for material obeying a neutron star equation of state, that of course you have the usual curve where as you go to larger and larger central density, you go to larger and larger masses. I'm plotting equilibrium mass versus equilibrium radius. And then there's a maximum mass, and you go over the other side and down, and that these stars at the lower density and larger radius are all stable, and that those at the higher density and smaller radius are unstable. And one can easily see this by recognizing that at the top of this curve, there is a mode of motion that takes you from one equilibrium configuration to another without any change of mass. And so you should be able to do that basically in the form of a zero frequency mode of oscillation of the star. Now, if we now set these stars vibrating, it must be, and you can show fairly easily, John showed us how to do this, that you can write the total mass of the vibrating star as a piece that depends on the total number of baryons the star has in it, and the radius, as the radius is slowly changing, it's vibrating in this fundamental mode. You're very close to this location in the mass-radius relation, and so this fundamental mode has very low frequency. So it's, for example, looking at one of these stars here. So a piece that depends on how many baryons are in the star and on its instantaneous radius, and then a kinetic energy piece. And quite naturally, the piece that doesn't depend on the time derivative of the radius, at fixed baryon number, for baryon number equal to that at the maximum of the curve, you have this piece looking like that. It's flat up here, so you have the zero frequency mode. If you have a star that is down here in terms of the equilibrium configuration, then in fact this piece, which acts as an effective potential in which the radius vibrates, this piece then has a minimum corresponding to stability. That piece has a maximum corresponding to instability. Now, Jim and I earlier in the early 1970s had struggled through trying to generalize this to rotating stars. I learned a lot in that process. Among other things, Jim came to me at one point and said, "We've got it all wrong," and explained to me why we had it all wrong. And it was a real struggle. It just turned out to be a lot easier to generalize it to stars that have are tidally coupled to companions. So let's talk about then the case where this star now has a tide that shows up in a quadrupole moment. These are the components of the, this, I'll use a scalar quantity Q to describe the quadrupole moment related to the components of the quadrupole moment in that way. A scalar quantity E to describe the tidal field of the companion related to the components in this way. As we know from the classical 19th century theory, Q has to be some constant times the radius of the star to the fifth power times the tidal field. Now, let's ask how much work is done on the star in the process of raising the tidal field. Suppose that we are to have the star at some moment of time, it is absolutely spherical, and the tide gets instantaneously turned on. The tide then raises the quadrupole moment, or it raises it, the tidal field E turns on a quadrupole moment, it deforms the star. The classical 19th century formula says that the amount of work that's done is minus one-half the tidal field times the rate of change of the quadrupole moment. And so, translated into the scalar quantities, it looks like this. Jim and I derived, using the formalism that Jim and I developed, I think one of my graduate students probably was the one, Jaukid Song, who derived an analogous formula, and showed that it was precisely the same in general relativity, except, and this is where, Jim, you and I think were confused, didn't understand what was going on, except for the fact that it was evident to Jim and me that there was a big ambiguity in what we meant by the mass of the star when it's tidally coupled to a companion at the level of the product of the external tidal field and the quadrupole moment. Well, tomorrow at the Pacific Coast Gravity Conference, one of the students in my group, and they've all come down here in the traditional manner for both for your birthday, Jim, and also for the conference. One of my students, Patricia Perdue, will explain how in Newtonian theory, this tidal quadrupolar interaction energy inside the LARF is also ambiguous by precisely that amount, but nevertheless, in Newtonian theory, the work that is done by the tidal field is absolutely precise. I think you can't raise any question of it. We know what we mean by how much work was done by the tidal field to raise that tide in Newtonian theory. But there is an ambiguity in the tidal quadrupole interaction energy that arises because in Newtonian theory, as in general relativity, localization of gravitational energy is ambiguous. You can say that the gravitational energy is localized in the field as an integral of the gradient of the Newtonian potential squared, say, or you can say it's localized in the matter as an integral of Newtonian potential times rho, times mass density. And you can relocalize the gravitational energy in Newtonian theory just as you can in relativity theory. And so what Patricia has done is shown then that just as in Newtonian theory, the interaction energy is ambiguous, but the work done is unambiguous. Similarly, in general relativity, that is the case. And so we have to take this formula for the interaction and for the work that is done to raise the tide seriously. Now, as this star slowly vibrates and its radius changes, then there is an amount of work done on the star by the tidal field given by that relation. Some of this work is used to raise the tide. This is the work that is done. But it takes energy to raise the tide, and obviously the energy, the actual energy used up in raising the tide goes as the square of the quadrupole moment. Then as the star vibrates, there's a conserved quantity, which is the original, basically, potential part of the mass of the star, plus the mass that's tied up in the tide, that is in the quadrupole moment of the star, having these lumps that have been raised up above the star's surface, plus the kinetic energy part during the vibration, that would be conserved if it weren't for the fact that the tidal field is doing work on the star as the star vibrates. So we've got to subtract off of the work that the tidal field does on the star as the star vibrates. And so this is the conserved quantity. The equilibrium value of the quadrupole moment is the minimum of this as you change Q, holding E and R fixed, and you recover the 19th century formula, inserting that back in here, you find the conserved quantity during vibration is a kinetic energy plus a modified potential part. The key thing is that modified potential part has a dependence on radius that makes it more negative at larger radii. And so that means that the potential in which the effective potential in which the star moves as it vibrates has a modified form that drops down deeper at large radii than it was before. Here is the thing that corresponds to the number of baryons where the star is marginally stable. It drops down deeper than it did before, and now that star is, in fact, fully stable. The stars are stabilized by the tidal coupling. And this follows through by basically repeating, then, in a sense, the old Wheeler stability analysis, but making use of the tools that Jim and I together developed for dealing with the transfer of energy and angular momentum through the LARF in the vicinity of a neutron star, say, or black hole. I'd like to change pace for the remaining time of this lecture and ask Jim for help and advice. We've got a problem with LIGO. I always like to look into the future. We've got the following problem, that we have very concrete plans for improving the first interferometers in LIGO. And those concrete plans entail then putting in enhancements of the interferometers in the period 2004 to 2006 that will bring the noise down at all frequencies. This is 10 hertz to 1,000 hertz. This is the noise in the detectors. Bring the noise way down so that we will have a factor of something like 20 improvement in H by 2006 over what we have at turn on at the end of 2001. Factor of 10 to the 4 improvement in event rate. But at that point, we are limited by the so-called standard quantum limit. The standard quantum limit is a limit that comes from the fact that our 11 kilogram test masses, by 2006, they've probably been increased to 30 kilograms. These test masses, the mirrors in LIGO, are behaving quantum mechanically. And we have to do then what is called quantum non-demolition interferometry to try to monitor the motions of those test mass mirrors, in some sense manipulating their wave functions in the process of collecting the data for an 11 kilogram object. So you know what I'm talking about. There is a picture of a mirror for LIGO 1, the first interferometers. It's been coated with a coating that is highly reflecting at 1 micron, the wavelength of the light that is used in LIGO. It's got a protective piece of material around the side so that the man who's handling it doesn't scratch it at all. But you see then, this is the object we're concerned about. We're concerned about the quantum mechanical behavior of the center of mass motion of this 11 kilogram object. And this is where we actually do need help and advice. So let me talk about the standard quantum limit from two different points of view. The first point of view says you go in and you first look at, well, let me first talk about the fact that about how it is that we're applying quantum mechanics to an object like this. We have 4 test masses. Each of them has an 11 kilogram mass. So there are about 3 times 10 to the 26 atoms in each test mass. That means there are 9 times 10 to the 26 degrees of freedom, all of them quantized, of course. But the light to the laser beam couples almost solely to just 1 degree of freedom out of the 4, because there are 4 test masses, times 9 times 10 to the 26. Now, 1 degree of freedom, which obviously has to obey quantum mechanics, just like all the other degrees of freedom do, is a difference in the center of mass degrees of freedom of the 4 test masses. So it's that one degree of freedom we're worried about. It's the one degree of freedom that the light couples to and the gravity waves couple to, and we're worried about dealing with its quantum mechanical behavior. The first point of view on the standard quantum limit says that each time you collect data by reading out the current coming off a photodetector in the LIGO interferometer, you're making a measurement of this degree of freedom X, and thereby you reduce the state of X, and it goes into some state that has a half width, or has a width that is, if you do the measurement really well, is equal to the inaccuracy or the error in your measurement. But then, during that time, between that time of that measurement and the next time you read out your data, which is about a half a gravity wave period later, so something like 5 milliseconds later, the wave function of that degree of freedom spreads in the usual manner that you get wave function spreading for a free particle. I should emphasize, because we are working around 100 hertz, the fact that these masses are hanging by wires is irrelevant. You can pretend that they're just free masses. At that high a frequency, the restoring force is not important. All this does is prevents us from damaging the test masses by letting them hit the floor. That's all the wire does. There's a second point. Oh, when you go through the numbers then, you wind up saying, if you made your measurement too accurate the first time, then the wave packet spreading will be too great. If you make it too poor in accuracy, well, then you wind up with just a very poor accuracy. So there's an optimal accuracy such that the wave packet spreading will be something like a factor of 2. And that gives us a resulting optimal accuracy for successive position measurements, which after all are the foundation for LIGO, corresponds in numbers to a gravity wave sensitivity of something like 6 times 10 to the minus 23, which is LIGO 2. LIGO 2 in the period 2004 to 2006 will be seeing, but just barely, at the noise level, as a significant contributor to the noise, something like a third of the noise or so, is coming from the finite half-width of the wave function of this degree of freedom. There's a second point of view you can take, and that is that we're measuring the motion of this test mass using light, and as a result, there is a back action of our measurement process. Photon shot noise produces a measurement noise that goes as 1 over the square root of the amount of light power we use. But the larger we make the light power, the larger will be the quantum mechanical fluctuations in the radiation pressure on the test mass mirrors. And so there's a back action that arises then from those quantum fluctuations of the light pressure, and that back action is proportional to the square root of the light power, and you do the optimization, you get the same standard quantum limit. We've been struggling to understand a very elementary question. Is this the same effect as that in disguise? Is state reduction the same thing as quantum as back reaction forces, or are they separate? And the answer has not been at all obvious to me, though I think that in the end, for LIGO, we can bring our instruments into a form where state reduction is irrelevant, and all we have to worry about is back action. I also think that it is probably true that if our goals were different from what they are, these would be two separate and independent processes. But we can design our instruments, I think, so that state reduction goes away as an issue, and we have to deal only with back action. But this really is a very important issue in quantum theory of measurement, and I have yet to find anybody who has been able to give me a definitive general answer for all measurement schemes, and I would love advice from Jim or from anybody else on this. These are, in fact, really practical issues now as we move into the 21st century, making measurements on systems like these kinds of sensitivities. So the challenge for LIGO 3, which is roughly the 2008 time frame, And I should back up and say, the LIGO team of scientists, or LIGO scientific collaboration that is working on the development of the detectors, now consists of about 200 scientists at about 20 different institutions. So it's a very spread out effort, going from Moscow westward through Western Europe, the United States, and out to Perth, Australia, with the major contributions coming from large numbers of different groups. Most of the effort now, in terms of R&D effort, is on LIGO 2. The design of LIGO 1 is frozen, and R&D is going on in LIGO 2, and now is the time when we're working on the conceptual designs for LIGO 3, which will be roughly the 2008 timeframe. Now, we have a choice in LIGO 3 as we try to improve the sensitivity further of either pushing our test mass up to something like 300 kilograms, because the standard quantum limit goes down as 1 over the square root of the mass, or doing quantum non-demolition, redesigning our interferometers so they can beat the standard quantum limit by cleverness instead of by brute force. The danger of the brute force technique is that as you drive those masses up, every time the test mass moves a little bit, it pulls very hard on the overhead support. The more massive it is, the larger that force coupling will be to the overhead support, and the easier it will be for energy to couple through the support and down into the ground, similarly for noise to couple up through the ground and down into the test mass. And it becomes a serious practical problem, most people on the LIGO scientific collaboration think, when you push up much above 30 kilograms. And so that's why we are now looking intensively at the problem of devising quantum non-demolition interferometer schemes. The lead has been taken on this by Braginsky's group in Moscow for the last several years, and in the last 6 months, I and my own group have joined into that effort, trying to see how to get a practical quantum non-demolition scheme. We have three approaches that we have been looking at. One says, let's monitor the momenta of the mirrors instead of monitoring the positions, for a reason I'll explain in just a moment. The second says, let's devise add-on optics for a conventional design, so we still monitor the center of mass positions, but we do something tricky about processing the light, either before it enters the interferometer or after it leaves. And the third says, let's redesign the instrument completely and use an internal readout scheme. The first two approaches have the advantage that they are not radical changes, not extremely radical changes from current design, somewhat radical, not extremely, but they require very high light power, more than a megawatt of circulating power in the Fabry-Perot cavities of the interferometer. And that high power through a slight amount of absorption in the mirrors leads to mirror heating, to thermal deformation of the mirrors, which can cause experimental problems. We may be able to deal with those larger powers, but there's great fear of them. And so an internal readout scheme that can operate at lower power looks very attractive. So those are the three approaches that I would like to talk about, at least the second one in a little bit of detail, and the others very briefly. Momentum-based interferometers, the key idea is that the trouble with monitoring position is that the commutator of the in the Heisenberg picture, the commutator of the position of a free mass with itself at different times is not zero, which means that if you measure position at one moment of time, that measurement is going to interfere with a measurement at a later moment of time. This leads, of course, to an uncertainty relation that gives back the standard quantum limit. The glory of measuring momenta is that it's a constant of the motion. The commutator of the momentum with itself at different times is zero. Correspondingly, there's no spreading of the wave function in momentum space, and you don't get standard quantum limit from it. So this is the obvious approach to follow. We do have a design. We have a way, what appears even to be a practical way, to redesign interferometers so they couple to momenta instead of to positions. But we think this is less practical, in fact, than the add-on schemes that stick with measuring position. And that's been the new insight for me in recent months, is that we don't have to switch over to monitoring a constant of the motion. And this insight has come from recognizing that our challenge, in fact, is not to measure the position or the momentum of a test mass. Rather, the challenge is something else. It's to get a highly classical gravitational wave signal through a quantum mechanical test mass without demolishing the signal's information. And the best approach to that is to try to get the highly classical gravitational signal through without getting any information out about the test mass itself. And so the name of the game is to redesign this instrument so that even though you couple to position, you still can get the signal throughout, the gravity wave signal out, and not get any position information out, even though the coupling is fundamentally to position. So that's the name of the game. Farid Khalili, who is a brilliant young theorist in Brzezinski's group, has never been west. We're bringing him west this summer for a few weeks, and whom I recommend people get acquainted with his work. He has given a beautiful pedagogical experiment example that explains how this is possible. Suppose that I have a classical force that's acting on a free mass. It's, for simplicity, a sinusoidal force. And so it gives rise to a motion, a position change of the free mass, which is a C number because the force is very classical. It's really a gravitational wave that is just then sinusoidal in frequency and looks like that as a function of time. I'm going to make three successive measurements of the position of this test mass, one at this time, the next at that time, the next at this time. And then I'll just do a numerical difference of the position here minus twice the position there plus the position here. And I will get out my signal, and I want, however, get the classical signal out. I want all of the properties of the test mass to drop out in the end. So I want to design the interaction so that that happens. I will do this in this thought experiment by using three separate measurement devices. Now, in LIGO, these measurement devices are really wave trains. Each measurement device is something like 10 to the 18 photons in a segment of the wave train. And they really are three separate measurement devices in that case, just as they are in this idealized example. I will use an obvious kind of interaction Hamiltonian for this measurement system with the free test mass, a delta function in time to make this pedagogically simple, a coupling constant, and then a coupling of position of the test mass, position operator plus the classical signal that I'm trying to measure, a coupling of the total position to the momentum of the measuring device. And I do three successive measurements at three successive times here, here, and here using that simple position-momentum coupling between the two. So I've looked then at the Heisenberg equations for the evolution of the readout variable. The readout variable will be Q. In a real LIGO instrument, the readout variable is a phase, a gravity wave phase, but it's converted into a photocurrent, and it ultimately becomes a photocurrent. This readout variable Q, after this very brief interaction, this delta function of time, it's equal to its initial value, I divided by K and multiplied by K, which is the coupling constant, then plus the position operator of the test mass and the position signal. So that's the readout variable, but I want to think of the readout variable as being this quantity, but just throw away, for thinking about it, the coupling constant K. So the real measured quantity that I'm going to read out is at time zero, is the position, the C number position of the test mass produced by the classical force, plus the position operator of the test mass, plus a measurement noise that's superposed on the output signal, which is my initial value of Q just before the measurement, divided by K. So there's always a superimposed measurement noise, which I will denote by a capital letter, and the small letter is the actual position operator of the test mass. This same Hamiltonian produces then a back action on the test mass. Oh, I should say, this will be photon shot noise in the real interferometer. The back action on the test mass, produced by the same very simple linearly coupled Hamiltonian, causes the test mass momentum after that measurement to be its value before the measurement, including the position operator, or the momentum operator of the test mass before the measurement, lowercase p, plus a back action piece, which is minus k times the momentum of the readout system of the. Now, a major issue that I never ever understood before, that seems to be a universal property of linearly coupled measuring systems of this simple sort, is that the commutator of the superimposed noise in the readout with the back action on the momentum of the test mass is minus I H bar. And that means, then, that the commutator of the readout observable, which includes, then, the signal we were trying to see, the position operator of the test mass, and the superimposed noise, the commutator of the readout signal with the momentum afterwards that includes the back action momentum is zero. And this is a very powerful tool in your hands if you're an experimenter. And it leads then to the next major conclusion, that when we make measurement number one, and we now have a readout variable for measurement number one that is the gravity wave signal at that later time, this should be an x0. That's the initial position operator, just like it was before. X0 plus this, because the position operator has evolved during the time between measurements, plus a superimposed noise from position from that measurement number one. If you look at the commutator of the readout variable for the first measurement, measurement zero, and the second measurement, measurement number one, that commutator boils down to, again, a canceling of an IH bar from the intrinsic properties of the test mass with a minus IH bar from the back action noise commutator with the superimposed noise, and it's zero. With linearly coupled systems, you can easily arrange then that you have a readout variable that you then read out with very high accuracy. In LIGO, you just count number of photons with high accuracy that have come in. The readout variable in successive measurements commutes with each other, so the readout variables can be treated as C numbers, and there is no issue of state reduction involved in the readout, because there is no problem with one readout interfering with the results of the subsequent readout. You go through the same argument, then, analysis for measurement number two, and then you build up the quantity that you want to get the gravity wave signal in. And lo and behold, all properties of the test mass have gone away. And the only thing that remains in this kind of a scheme where you're going after a classical force that's acting on this test mass is the back action noise and the superimposed and the superimposed noise. This should be a capital X1 there. And you can just look at this expression for the thing that you want to finally build in the in your data analysis. And you can argue on the basis of the fact that the readout variables commute with each other for successive measurements, you can argue that, in fact, when you do this process, you do the data analysis, the expectation value for this will just be the expectation value of the right-hand side in the states of the readout instruments at the beginning of the readout measurement. And the variances will be the variances of this in those states. And you look at this expression and you see that the following, that in fact, as I have said, that the test mass variables do not influence the measurement accuracy. And that if you then put your first readout device in a state that produces no superimposed noise, which means there's huge back action that shakes the test mass, you put your last readout device in a way that puts no superimposed noise, so there's huge back action that shakes the test mass. You put the middle readout device, which is the generic one in LIGO, into a state where you have a correlation between its back action force and the superimposed noise. Then you can make an arbitrarily accurate measurement. But experimentally, then, the challenge for LIGO is to design schemes where you build just the right correlations into the back action force, radiation pressure force that acts on the test masses, and the superimposed photon shot noise. We know how to do that. I run out of time, so I won't describe precisely how to do that, but we have several different schemes for doing that. In fact, the first such scheme was devised, in the 1980s, by Bill Unruh and Carlton Caves. We now understand it much more deeply, and we understand how to do it in a probably more practical manner to build in the necessary correlations between the radiation pressure fluctuations and the superimposed shot noise. Let me just wind up at the end by a word about internal readout schemes. The trouble with these add-on schemes, and I should say these add-on schemes that I have sloughed over, I've just motivated them, merely involve appropriate processing of the light before it enters the interferometer or appropriate processing of the light after it leaves, and you don't have to change the structure of the interferometer at all. That's the beauty of them. But they require very high light power. So Braginsky's group has conceived schemes that can operate at much lower light power. And they generally have this kind of a character. You have LIGO with two arms, and you excite it by laser light coming in from the end instead of coming in from the corner. These are the usual kinds of heavy test masses. You put a very light test mass in here. This might be a few grams, and these 10 kilograms. You then put in enough laser light, which turns out to be a megawatt times the ratio of the masses, so it can be a small laser power. Enough laser light that when the gravity wave pushes this mirror out, pushes that mirror in, then this test mass will be pushed in lockstep with those mirrors. So it just gets pushed back and forth relative to local inertial frames here. So you have transferred a signal which originally consisted of the motion of inertial frames there and there relative to each other. You've turned it into a motion of this small test mass relative to local inertial frames. You've done it with light that has a relatively low power. But then you have to design a local readout system, which Braginsky likes to call a speed meter, to read out the motion of this light little test mass relative to local inertial frames. And there's a description of such a speed meter in this paper, and there's a much more detailed description in a paper that Braginsky, Gordievsky, Khalili, and I are in the process of writing. We don't yet have a fully viable scheme of this sort, but it does show promise, and we need to keep working it, promise of beating the standard quantum limit with low light powers. And I hope this is where we wind up, but at least we seem to have other schemes that will do it with high light powers. So I'm optimistic for LIGO 3, but the struggle to understand these issues, the struggle to design quantum non-demolition interferometers for LIGO 3 has been a real intellectual struggle for me over the last 6 months, and it would sure help if I understood quantum theory of measurement the way Jim does. And we would all appreciate working, those of us working on this, advice and ideas from people who really do understand quantum measurements really well. Thanks.
Thank you, Kev. We have time for a couple of questions.
In all the discussion of the quantum non-Moritian experiments, you need technically the system to be linear so that you know what variable you are going to monitor. How much non-linearities are there in the big experimental arrangement like this, which may be difficult to overcome?
So how much non-linearities are there in this big experimental device that may get in the way of trying to operate in a linear domain? There's enough that people really work on that and work on controlling them in the classical domain. Non-linear coupling, for example, gives upconversion of low-frequency seismic noise into the LIGO band, and the control of that upconversion is a significant issue experimentally. And so that is a significant part of the experimental game in the classical domain. In the quantum domain, for the amounts of quantum non-demolition that we need, let me just give you a number. Each time we make a factor 2 improvement, so if we just do a factor of 50% quantum non-demolition, we improve our event rate by the cube of that by nearly a factor of 10. So we only need small amounts of quantum non-demolition. And I don't see non-linearities as being a major issue compared to other issues in implementing QND, though they are in sort of a general major experimental issue in dealing with other kinds of noise in the instruments.
One more. You're talking about monitoring about the spread of the wave packet in between measurements, and I was just wondering what the effective rate of measurement is from decoherence, not from your own attempted measurement,
but
from whatever random
interactions are. So the issue is, what are the effects of decoherence from things other than your own measurement? The characteristic measure of that is the dissipation that you have in the test masses, because the decoherence is going to arise due to a coupling into the environment. That coupling shows up as dissipation, and so you can measure the dissipation just in the form of friction, and then you can compute the effects of quantum fluctuations coming in through those same routes. And the characteristic time scale for dissipation in the test masses, either radiative dissipation through coupling to the light or dissipation through coupling to phonon modes in the suspension system or internal phonon modes in the mirrors, that characteristic coupling time for LIGO, for LIGO 3, it will probably be something like 10 years. For LIGO 1, I don't know the precise number, but it's probably of the order of a few days. But those numbers are very long compared to our readout times. So the principal problem there, then, is the fact that the environment is at finite temperature, and so it's the thermal fluctuations that creep in rather than the decoherence. But they're creeping in with this very long characteristic time scale.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the answer to your question, Kip, but I mean, from the general point of view, when you look at the whole thing as a closed system, I mean, you need the histories of whatever it is the readout is to decohere, right? Which means, you know, the typical mechanisms of decoherence involve a coupling somewhere to something, right? And they produce noise. So, but, you know, you don't necessarily need the test band to decohere, right? So you may be able to hop from here, which I presume is the thrust of your remarks.
Yeah. Yeah.
The classical gravitational wave signals or whatever, actually, that's the only...
Yeah. So that's what I think we have learned how to do recently in the case of measuring a classical force. If our goal, if this is one
This is just one direction of QND technology. I mean, similar technology is beginning to be developed in nanoscale physics. Michael Rukas's group at Caltech is setting up to do QND type experiments with nanostructures. It's occurring with manipulation of atoms interacting with non-classical light in Jeff Kimball's lab at Caltech. In fact, much of our coming to understand this comes through interacting with these guys in other fields. Much of that is going to involve not just trying to process classical signals, but also quantum signals and quantum information, and also trying to get at experimentally at the variables, things like positions and momenta of test masses. So I think that it's going to be important more generally to understand this kind of an issue. For our problem, you give me encouragement that we are probably on, that we may be on the right track, and that we
but
really can do it.
Take a look from this more general perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I want to correct for the audience one impression. It isn't true that I worked out the theory of the tides in the 19th century.
Really? I knew you were older than me.
Really reported on the work of Sir George Darwin, in fact. Anyway, if I want to kind of fit an idea, go way, way back, and I can safely say that he's a person not only whom I've learned a great deal from. For example, I was trained in the Kip Thorne School of Computing very early, which was basically, let's forget about fancy algorithms, do the intervals by the trapezoidal rule, stay up all night, right, and get it finished by tomorrow morning, no matter how much it costs. But I learned other things from him. Well, I would say that I learned not only from him, but also from the students, the wonderful sort of group of students that he's had that have gone out through the world. In connection with the decadal survey, I tried to count up which is PhD institutions had contributed. Well, I made a list from hundreds or so gravitational physicists that I thought were working actively, and I remembered what their PhD institutions were, and I tried to see the ranking. Mr. Kuhn, were a bunch up at the top, they were pretty close. But the number one institution was Caltech. One of those points to me myself, right?
For which I claim no responsibility.
To you. He mentioned his experience with John about writing a book. I'd never heard that, and it probably is completely false given the generosity with which he treated other contributions of mine during the work, during his talk, and it's not, several thousand years ago, Cicero said, times are bad, children are not obeying their parents, and everyone is writing a book. Tip doesn't fall in that class. Well, okay, I mean, I can just say thank you, and it's evident that I still have a great deal to learn from you. Thanks.